shaking his head solemnly at the truth of it. As one day we all shall be finished. Ari, my dear, be zealous, therefore, and repent. Or, Airi, it was such a good film. The end was great. Hortense Bowden, tearfully.
And them that expect such an end of this world will be sorely disappointed, for he will come trailing terror and lure the generation that witnessed the events of 1914 shall now witness the third part of the trees burn, and the third part of the sea become as blood, and the third part of the...
And then there was Hortense's horror of weather reports. Whoever it was, however benign, honey-voiced and inoffensively dressed, she cursed them bitterly for the 5 minutes they stood there, and then, out of what appeared to be sheer perversity, proceeded to take the opposite of whatever advice had been proffered. Light jacket and no umbrella for rain, full cagoule and rain hat for sun. It was several weeks before Airi understood that weathermen were the secular antithesis of Hortense's life work, which was, essentially, a kind of supercosmic attempt to second-guess the Lord with one almighty biblical exegesis of a weather report. Next to that, weathermen were nothing but upstarts. And tomorrow, coming in from the east, we can expect a great furnace to rise up and envelop the area with flames that give no light, but rather darkness visible. While, I'm afraid, the northern regions are advised to wrap up warm against thick-ribbed ice, and there's a fair likelihood that the coast will be beaten with perpetual storms of whirlwind and dire hail, which on firm land thaws not. Michael Fish and his ilk were stabbers in the dark, trusting to the tomfoolery of the Met Office, making a mockery of that precise science, eschatology, that Hortense had spent over 50 years in the study of.
"Any news, Mr. Tapps?"
This question almost invariably asked over breakfast, and girlishly, breathlessly, like a child asking after Santa.
"No, Mrs. B, we are still completing our studies. You must let my colleagues and myself deliberate thoroughly. In this life, there are them that are teachers, and then there are them that are pupils. There are 8 million witnesses of Jehovah waiting for our decision, waiting for the judgment day. But you must learn to leave such things to them that have the direct line, Mrs. B. The direct line."
After bunking for a few weeks, Airi returned to school, but it seemed so distant. Even the journey from south to north each morning felt like an almighty polar trek, and worse, one that stopped short of its goal and ended up instead in the tepid regions, a non-event compared with the boiling maelstrom of the Bowden home. "So then, because thou art lukewarm and neither cold nor hot, I will spew thee out of my mouth." You become so used to extremity, suddenly nothing else will do. She saw Milat regularly, but their conversations were brief. He was green-tied now, and otherwise engaged. She still did Marcus's filing twice a week, but avoided the rest of the family. She saw Josh fleetingly. He seemed to be avoiding the Chalfins as assiduously as she. Her parents she saw on weekends, icy occasions, when everybody called everybody by their first names. "Airi, can you pass the salt to Archie? Clara, Archie wants to know where the scissors are," and all parties felt deserted. She sensed that she was being whispered about in NW2, the way North Londoners will when they suspect someone of coming down with religion, that nasty disease. So she hurried back to number 28 Lindacre Road, Lambeth, relieved to be back in the darkness, for it was like hibernating or being cocooned, and she was as curious as everyone else to see what kind of Airi would emerge. It wasn't any kind of prison. That house was an adventure. In cupboards and neglected drawers and in grimy frames were the secrets that had been hoarded for so long, as if secrets were going out of fashion. She found pictures of her great-grandmother Ambrosia, a bony, beautiful thing, with huge almond eyes, and one of Charlie Whitey Durham, standing in a pile of rubble with a sepia-print sea behind him. She found a Bible with one line torn from it. She found photo booth snaps of Clara in school uniform, grinning maniacally, the true horror of the teeth revealed. She read alternately from Dental Anatomy by Gerald M. Cavey and The Good News Bible, and raced voraciously through Hortense's small and eclectic library, blowing the red dust of Jamaican Schoolhouse off the covers and often using a penknife to cut never-before-read pages. February's list was as follows. An Account of a West Indian Sanatorium by George J. H. Sutton Moxley, London, Sampson, Lowe, Marston and Company, 1886. There was an inverse correlation between the length of the author's name and the poor quality of his book. Tom Kringle's Log by Michael Scott, Edinburgh, 1875. In Sugar Cane Land by Eden Philpotts, London, McClure and Company, 1893. Dominica Hints and Notes to Intending Settlers by His Honour H. Esketh Bell, CMG. London, A&C, Black, 1906. The more she read, the more that picture of dashing Captain Durham aroused her natural curiosity. Handsome and melancholy, surveying the bricks of half a church, looking worldly wise despite his youth, looking every inch the Englishman, looking like he could tell someone or another a thing or two about something. Maybe Irie herself. Just in case, she kept him under her pillow. And in the mornings, it wasn't Italianate vineyards out there anymore. It was sugar, sugar, sugar. And next door was nothing but tobacco, and she presumptuously fancied that the smell of plantain sent her back to somewhere, somewhere quite fictional, for she'd never been there. Somewhere Columbus called St. Jago, but the Arawak stubbornly renamed Zaimaka, the name lasting longer than they did. Well wooded and watered. Not that Irie had heard of those little sweet-tempered, pot-bellied victims of their own sweet tempers. Those were some other Jamaicans, fallen short of the attention span of history. She laid claim to the past, her version of the past, aggressively, as if retrieving misdirected mail. So this was where she came from. This all belonged to her, her birthright, like a pair of pearl earrings or a post office bond. X marks the spot, and Irie put an X on everything she found, collecting bits and bobs, birth certificates, maps, army reports, news articles, and storing them under the sofa, so that, as if by osmosis, the richness of them would pass through the fabric while she was sleeping and seep right into her. As the buds came with the spring, so like any anchoress, she was visited. First by voices, coming crackling over Hortense's Neolithic radio, Joyce Chalfin on Gardner's Question Time. Foreman. Another question from the audience, I think. Mrs. Sally Whittaker from Bournemouth has a question for the panel, I believe. Mrs. Whittaker. Mrs. Whittaker. Thank you, Brian. Well, I'm a new gardener, and this is my first frost, and in 2 short months, my garden's gone from being a real colour explosion to a very bare thing indeed. Friends have advised flowers with a compact habit, but that leaves me with lots of tiny auricula and double daisies, which looks silly because the garden's really quite large. Now, I'd really like to plant something a little more striking, around the height of a delphinium, but then the wind gets it and people look over their fences thinking, dear, oh dear. Sympathetic laughter from the studio audience. So, my question to the panel is, how do you keep up appearances in the bleak midwinter?
Foreman.
Thank you, Mrs. Whittaker. Well, it's a common problem, and it doesn't necessarily get any easier for the seasoned gardener. Personally, I never get it quite right. Well, let's hand the question over to the panel, shall we? Joyce Chalfin, any answers or suggestions for the bleak midwinter?
Joyce Chalfin.
Well, first I must say your neighbours sound very nosy. I'd tell them to mind their own beeswax if I were you.
Laughter from audience.
But to be serious, I think this whole trend for round-the-clock bloom is actually very unhealthy for the garden and the gardener, and particularly the soil. I really do. I think the winter should be a time of rest, subdued colours, you know, and then when the late spring does finally arrive, the neighbours get a hell of a shock. Boom! There it is, this wonderful explosion of growth. I think the deep winter is really a time for nurturing the soil, turning it over, allowing it to rest, and plotting its future all the better to surprise the nosy people next door. I always think of a garden soil like a woman's body, moving in cycles, you know, fertile at some times,
and not others, and that's really quite natural. But if you really are determined, then Lenten roses, Helleborus corsicus, do remarkably well in cold, calcareous soil, even if they're quite in the... Iris switched Joyce off. It was quite therapeutic switching Joyce off. This was not entirely personal. It just seemed tiring and unnecessary all of a sudden. That struggle to force something out of the recalcitrant English soil. Why bother when there was now this other place? For Jamaica appeared to Irie as if it were newly made, like Columbus himself. Just by discovering it, she had brought it into existence. This well-wooded and watered place, where things sprang from the soil riotously and without supervision, and a young white captain could meet a young black girl with no complications, both of them fresh and untainted and without past or dictated future. A place where things simply were. No fictions, no myths, no lies, no tangled webs. This is how Irie imagined her homeland. Because homeland is one of the magical fantasy words like unicorn and soul and infinity that have now passed into the language. And the particular magic of homeland, its particular spell over Irie, was that it sounded like a beginning, the beginningest of beginnings, like the first morning of Eden and the day after apocalypse, a blank page. But every time Irie felt herself closer to it, to the perfect blankness of the past, something of the present would ring the Bowden doorbell and intrude. Mothering Sunday brought a surprise visit from Joshua, angry on the doorstep, at least a stone and a half lighter, and much scruffier than usual. Before Irie had a chance to express either concern or shock, he had flounced into the lounge and slammed the door. "I'm sick of it! Sick to the back fucking teeth with it!" The vibration of the door knocked Captain Durham from his perch on Irie's windowsill, and she carefully re-erected him. "Yeah, nice to see you too, man. Why don't you sit down and slow down? Sick of what?"
"Them! They sicken me! They go on about rights and freedoms, and then they eat 50 chickens every fucking week! Hypocrites!"
Irie couldn't immediately see the connection. She took out a fag in preparation for a long story. To her surprise, Joshua took one too, and they went to kneel on the window seat, blowing smoke through the grate up into the street.
"Do you know how battery chickens live?"
Irie didn't. Joshua explained. Cooped up for most of their poor chicken lives in total chicken darkness, packed together like chicken sardines in their chicken shit and fed the worst type of chicken grain. And this, according to Joshua, was apparently nothing on how pigs and cows and sheep spent their time.
"It's a fucking crime! But try telling Marcus that. Try getting him to give up his Sunday hogfest. He's so fucking ill-informed. Have you ever noticed that? He knows this enormous amount about one thing, but there's this whole other world that... Oh, before I forget, you should take a leaflet."
Irie never thought she would see the day when Joshua Chalfin handed her a leaflet, but here it was in her palm. It was called Meat is Murder, The Facts and the Fiction, a publication from the Fate organization.
"It stands for Fighting Animal Torture and Exploitation. They're like the hardcore end of Greenpeace, or whatever. Read it. They're not just hippie freaks. They're coming from a solid scientific and academic background, and they're working from an anarchist perspective. I feel like I've really found my niche, you know? It's a really incredible group, dedicated to direct action. The deputy's an ex-Oxford fellow."
"How's Milat?"
Joshua shook off the question.
"Oh, I don't know. Barmy. Going barmy. And Joyce is still pandering to his every whim. Just don't ask me. They all sicken me. Everything's changed."
Josh ran his fingers anxiously through his hair, which just reached his shoulders now in what Wilsoners affectionately called a Jufro mullet.
"I just can't tell you how everything's changed. I'm having these real moments of clarity."
Irie nodded. She was sympathetic to moments of clarity. Her 17th year was proving chock-a-block with them, and she wasn't surprised by Joshua's metamorphosis. 4 months in the life of a 17-year-old is the stuff of swings and roundabouts, Stones fans into Beatles fans, Tories into Liberal Democrats and back again, vinyl junkies to CD freaks. Never again in your life do you possess the capacity for such total personality overhaul.
"I knew you'd understand. I wish I'd talked to you before, but I just can't bear to be in the house these days, and when I do see you, Milat always seems to be in the way. It's really good to see you.
You too. You look different. Josh gestured dismissively at his clothes, which were distinctly less nerdy than they had been.
I guess you can't wear your father's old corduroy forever.
I guess not.
Joshua clapped his hands together.
Well, I've booked my ticket for Glastonbury and I might not come back. I met these people from Fate and I'm going with them.
It's March, not till the summer, surely.
Jolie and Crispin. That's these people I met. Say we might go up there early, you know, camp out for a bit.
And school?
If you can bunk, I can bunk. It's not as if I'm going to fall behind. I've still got a chafing head on my shoulders. I'll just come back for the exams and then fuck off again. Irie, you've just got to meet these people. They're just incredible. He's a Dadaist, and she's an anarchist. A real one, not like Marcus. I told her about Marcus and his bloody future mouse. She thinks he's a dangerous individual, quite possibly psychopathic.
Irie thought about this. I'd be surprised. Without stubbing out his fag, he threw it up onto the pavement.
And I'm giving up all meat. I'm a pescatarian at the moment, but that's just half measures. I'm becoming a fucking vegetarian.
Irie shrugged, not certain what the right response should be.
There's a lot to be said for the old motto, you know.
Old motto?
Fight fire with fire. It's only by really fucking extreme behaviour that you can get through to somebody like Marcus. He doesn't even know how out there he is. There's no point being reasonable with him because he thinks he owns reasonableness. How do you deal with people like that? Oh, and I'm giving up leather, wearing it, and all other animal byproducts, gelatin and stuff.
After a while of watching the feet go by, leathers, sneakers, heels, Irie said, "That'll show 'em." On April Fool's Day, Samard turned up. He was all in white, on his way to the restaurant, crumpled and creased like a disappointed saint. He looked to be on the brink of tears. Irie let him in.
"Hello, Miss Jones," said Samard, bowing ever so slightly. "And how is your father?"
Irie smiled with recognition. "You see him more than we do. How's God?"
"Perfectly fine, thank you. Have you seen my good-for-nothing son recently?"
Before Irie had a chance to give her next line, Samard broke down in front of her and had to be led into the living room, sat in Darkus's chair, and brought a cup of tea before he could speak. "Mr. Iqbal, what's wrong?"
"What is right?"
"Has something happened to Dad?"
"Oh, no, no, no. Archibald is fine. He is like the washing machine advert. He carries on and on as ever."
"Then what?"
"Milat. He has been missing these 3 weeks."
"God. Well, have you tried the Chalfins?"
"He is not with them. I know where he is. Out of the frying pan and into the fire. He is on some retreat with these lunatic green tie people in a sports center in Chester."
"Bloody hell." Irie sat down cross-legged and took out a fag. "I hadn't seen him in school, but I didn't realize how long it had been. But if you know where he is..."
"I didn't come here to find him. I came to ask your advice, Irie. What can I do? You know him. How does one get through?"
Irie bit her lip, her mother's old habit. "I mean, I don't know. We're not as close as we were, but I've always thought that maybe it's the Majid thing, missing him. I mean, he'd never admit it, but Majid's his twin, and maybe if he saw him..."
"No, no, 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 no. I wish that were the solution. Allah knows how I pinned all my hopes on Majid. And now he says he is coming back to study the English law, paid for by these Chalfin people. He wants to enforce the laws of man rather than the laws of God. He has learnt none of the lessons of Muhammad. Peace be upon him. Of course, his mother is delighted, but he is nothing but a disappointment to me. More English than the English. Believe me, Majid will do Milat no good, and Milat will do Majid no good. They have both lost their way, strayed so far from the life I had intended for them. No doubt they will both marry white women called Sheila and put me in an early grave. All I wanted was 2 good Muslim boys. Oh, Irie."
Samad took her free hand and patted it with sad affection.
I just don't understand where I have gone wrong. You teach them, but they do not listen because they have the public enemy music on at full blast. You show them the road and they take the bloody path to the inns of court. You guide them and they run from your grasp to a Chester sports sector. You try to plan everything and nothing happens in the way that you expected.
But if you could begin again, thought Irie, if you could take them back to the source of the river, to the start of the story, to the homeland. But she didn't say that, because he felt it as she felt it, and both knew it was as useless as chasing your own shadow. Instead, she took her hand from underneath his and placed it on top, returning the stroke.
Oh, Mr. Iqbal, I don't know what to say.
There are no words. The one I send home comes out a pucker Englishman, white-suited, silly-wig lawyer. The one I keep here is fully paid-up, green bow-tie-wearing, fundamentalist terrorist. I sometimes wonder why I bother,
said Samad bitterly, betraying the English inflections of 20 years in the country.
I really do. These days it feels to me like you make a devil's pact when you walk into this country. You hand over your passport at the check-in, you get stamped, you want to make a little money, get yourself started. But you mean to go back? Who would want to stay? Cold, wet, miserable, terrible food, dreadful newspapers. Who would want to stay? In a place where you are never welcomed, only tolerated. Just tolerated. Like you are an animal finally house-trained. Who would want to stay? But you have made a devil's pact. It drags you in and suddenly you are unsuitable to return. Your children are unrecognizable. You belong nowhere.
Oh, that's not true, surely.
And then you begin to give up the very idea of belonging. Suddenly this thing, this belonging, it seems like some long, dirty lie. And I begin to believe that birthplaces are accidents, that everything is an accident. But if you believe that, where do you go? What do you do? What does anything matter?
As Samad described this dystopia with a look of horror, Irie was ashamed to find that the land of accidents sounded like paradise to her, sounded like freedom.
Do you understand, child? I know you understand.
And what he really meant was, do we speak the same language? Are we from the same place? Are we the same? Irie squeezed his hand and nodded vigorously, trying to ward off his tears. What else could she tell him but what he wanted to hear?
Yes, she said. Yes, yes, yes.
When Hortense and Ryan came home that evening after a late-night prayer meeting, both were in a state of high excitement. Tonight was the night. After giving Hortense a flurry of instructions as to the typesetting and layout of his latest Watchtower article, Ryan went into the hallway to make his telephone call to Brooklyn to get the news.
But I thought he was in consultation with them.
Yes, yes, he is. But the final confirmation, you understand, must come from Mr. Charles Wintry himself in Brooklyn,
said Hortense breathlessly.
What a day this is! What a day! Help me with lifting this typewriter now. I need it on the table.
Irie did as she was told, carrying the enormous old Remington to the kitchen and laying it down in front of Hortense. Hortense passed Irie a bundle of white paper covered in Ryan's tiny script.
Now you read that to me, Irie Ambrosia, slowly now, and I'll get it down in type.
Irie read for half an hour or so, wincing at Ryan's horrible corkscrew prose, passing the whiting fluid when it was required, and gritting her teeth at the author's interruptions as every 10 minutes he popped back into the room to adjust his syntax or rephrase a paragraph.
Mr. Tapps, did you get through yet?
Not yet, Mrs. B, not yet. Very busy, Mr. Charles Wintry. I'm going to try again now.
A sentence, Samad's sentence, was passing through Irie's tired brain. Sometimes I wonder why I bother. And now that Ryan was out of the way, Irie saw her opportunity to ask it.
though she framed it carefully. Hortense leant back in her chair and placed her hands on her lap.
I been doing this a very long time, Irie Ambrosia. I been waiting ever since I was a pickney in long socks.
But that's no reason.
What do you know for reasons? Nothing at all. The Witness Church is where my roots are. It been good to me when nobody else has. It was the good thing my mother gave me, and I'm not going to let it go now we're so close to the end.
But, Gran, it's not...
You won't ever... Let me tell you something. I'm not like them witnesses just scared of dying. Just scared. Them want everybody to die except them. That's not a reason to dedicate your life to Jesus Christ. I got very different aims. I still hope to be one of the anointed, even if I am a woman. I want it all my life. I want to be there with the Lord, making the laws and the decisions.
Hortense sucked her teeth long and loud.
I got so tired with the church always telling me I'm a woman or I'm not educated enough. Everybody always trying to educate you. Educate you about this, educate you about that. That's always been the problem with the women in this family. Somebody always trying to educate them about something, pretending it all about learning when it all about a battle of the wills. But if I were one of the 144, no one go and try to educate me. That would be my job. I'd make my own laws and I wouldn't be wanting anybody else's opinions. My mother was strong-willed deep down and I'm the same. Lord knows your mother was the same and you the same.
Tell me about Ambrosia, said Irie, spotting a chink in Hortense's armour that one might squeeze through. Please. But Hortense remained solid.
You know enough already. The past is done with. Nobody learned nothing from it. Top of page 5, please. I think that's where we were.
At that moment, Ryan returned to the room, face redder than ever.
What, Mr. Tapps? Is it? Do you know?
God help the heathen, Mrs. B., for the day is indeed at hand. It is as the Lord laid out clearly in his book of Revelation. He never intended a third millennium. Now, I'll need that article typed up, and then another one that I'll dictate to you off the cuff. You'll need to telephone all the Lambeth members and leaflet the...
Oh, yes, Mr. Tapps. But just let me take it in just a minute. It couldn't be any other date, could it, Mr. Tapps? I told you I felt it in my bones.
I'm not sure as to how much your bones had to do with it, Mrs. B. Surely more credit is due to the thorough scriptural study done by myself and my colleagues.
And God, presumably, said Irie, cutting him a sharp glare, going over to hold Hortense, who was shaking with sobs. Hortense kissed Irie on both cheeks, and Irie smiled at the hot wetness.
Oh, Irie Ambrosia, I'm so glad you're here to share this. I lived this century. I came into this world in an earthquake at the very beginning, and I shall see the evil and sinful pollution be erased in a mighty rumbling earthquake once more. Praise the Lord! It is as he promised after all. I knew I'd make it. I got just 7 years to wait. 92!
Hortense sucked her teeth contemptuously.
Choo! My grandmother lived to see 103, and the woman could skip road till the day she kill over and drop coal. Me go and make it. I make it this far. My mother suffered to get me here, but she knew the true church, and she make effort to push me out in the most difficult circumstances so I could live to see that glory day.
Amen.
Oh, amen, Mr. Tapps. Put on the complete suit of armor of God. Now, Irie Ambrosia, witness me as I say it. I'm going to be there, and I'm going to be in Jamaica to see it. I'm going home that year of our Lord, and you can come there too if you learn from me and listen. You want to come to Jamaica in the year 2000?
Irie let out a little scream and rushed to give her grandmother another hug. Hortense wiped her tears with her apron.
Lord Jesus, I lived this century. Well and truly, I live this terrible century with all its troubles and vexations. And thanks to you, lad, I'm going to feel a rumble at both ends.
Majid, Milat, and Marcus. 1992-1999. Fundamental. ANN. Late Middle English. Adjective. 1. Of or pertaining to the basis of groundwork, going to the root of the matter. 2. Serving as the base or foundation, primary, original, from which others are derived. 3. Of or pertaining to the foundation, foundations of a building. 4. Of a stratum, lowest, lying at the bottom. Fundamentalism, noun. East 20th century, feminine, folio, preceding, plus, ism. The strict maintenance of traditional orthodox religious beliefs or doctrines. ESP, especially, belief in the inerrancy of religious texts. The new shorter Oxford English Dictionary. You must remember this. A kiss is still a kiss. A sigh is just a sigh. The fundamental things apply as time goes by. Herman Hupfeld, As Time Goes By, 1931 song. 16. The Return of Majid Mahfuz Murshed Mubtazim Iqbal. Excuse me. You're not going to smoke that, are you? Marcus closed his eyes. He hated the construction. He always wanted to reply with equal grammatical perversity. Yes, I'm not going to smoke that. No, I am going to smoke that. Excuse me. I said you're... Yes, I heard you the first time, said Marcus softly, turning to his right to see the speaker with whom he shared a single armrest, each two chairs being assigned only one between them in the long line of molded plastic. Is there a reason why I shouldn't? Irritation vanished at the sight of his interlocutor, a slim, pretty Asian girl with an alluring gap between her front teeth, army trousers and a high ponytail, who was holding in her lap, of all things, a copy of his collaborative pop science book of last spring with the novelist Surrey T. Banks, Time Bombs and Body Clocks, Adventures in Our Genetic Future. Yes, there's a reason, asshole. You can't smoke in Heathrow, not in this bit of it, and you certainly can't smoke a fucking pipe. And these chairs are welded to each other, and I've got asthma. Enough reasons? Marcus shrugged amiably. Yes, more than. Good book. This was a new experience for Marcus, meeting one of his readers, in the waiting lounge of an airport. He had been a writer of academic texts all his life, texts whose audience was tiny and select, whose members he more often than not knew personally. He had never sent his work off into the world like a party popper, unsure where the different strands would land. Pardon? Don't worry. I won't smoke if you don't want me to. I was just wondering, is it a good book? The girl screwed up her face, which was not as pretty as Marcus had first thought, the jawline a tad too severe. She closed the book, she was halfway through, and looked at its cover as if she'd forgotten which book it was. Oh, it's all right, I suppose. Bit bloody weird, bit of a head fuck. Marcus frowned. The book had been his agent's idea. A split-level, high-low culture book whereby Marcus wrote a hard science chapter on one particular development in genetics, and then the novelist wrote a twin chapter exploring these ideas from a futuristic, fictional, what-if-this-led-to-this point of view, and so on for 8 chapters each. Marcus had university-bound sons plus Majid's law schooling to think about, and he had agreed to the project for pecuniary reasons. To that end, the book had not been the hit that was hoped for or acquired, and Marcus, when he thought of it at all, thought it was a failure. But weird? A head fuck? In what way weird? The girl looked suddenly suspicious. What is this, an interrogation? Marcus shrank back a little. His chauvinist confidence was always less evident when he strayed abroad, away from the bosom of his family. He was a direct man who saw no point in asking anything other than the direct questions, but in recent years he had become aware that this directness did not always garner direct answers from strangers, as it did in his own small circle. In the outside world, outside of his college and home, one had to add things to speech, particularly if one was somewhat strange-looking, as Marcus gathered he was, if one was a little old, with eccentric curly hair and spectacles missing their lower rims. You had to add things to your speech to make it more palatable. Niceties, throwaway phrases, pleases and thank yous. No, not an interrogation. I was just thinking of reading it myself, you see. I heard it was quite good, you know, and I was wondering why you thought it was weird. The girl, deciding at that moment that Marcus was neither mass murderer nor rapist, let her muscles relax and slid back in her chair. Oh, I don't know. Not so much weird, I guess. More scary. Scary? How? Well, it's scary, isn't it? All this genetic engineering. Is it? Yeah, you know, messing about with the body. They reckon there's a gene for intelligence, sexuality, practically everything, you know. Recombinant DNA technology, said the girl, using the term cautiously, as if testing the water to see how much Marcus knew. Seeing no recognition in his face, she continued with more confidence. Once you know the restriction enzyme for a particular, like, bit of DNA, you can switch anything on or off, like a bloody stereo. That's what they're doing to those poor mice. It's pretty fucking scary. Not to mention, like, the pathogenic, i.e. disease-producing, organisms they've got sitting in petri dishes all over the place. I mean, I'm a politics student, yeah? And I'm like, what are they creating? And who do they want to wipe out? You've got to be seriously naive if you don't think the West intends to use this shit in the East, on the Arabs. Quick way to deal with the fundamentalist Muslims. No, seriously, man, said the girl in response to a raised eyebrow from Marcus. Things are getting scary. I mean, reading this shit, you just realise how close science is to science fiction. As far as Marcus could see, science and science fiction were like ships in the night, passing each other in the fog. A science fiction robot, for example, even his son Oscar's expectation of a robot, was 1,000 years ahead of anything either robotics or artificial intelligence could yet achieve. While the robots in Oscar's mind were singing, dancing, and empathizing with his every joy and fear, over at MIT, some poor bastard was slowly and painstakingly trying to get a machine to recreate the movements of a single human thumb. On the flip side of the coin, the simplest biological facts, the structure of animal cells, for instance, were a mystery to all but 14-year-old children and scientists like himself. The former spending their time drawing them in class, the latter injecting them with foreign DNA. In between, or so it appeared to Marcus, flowed a great ocean of idiots, conspiracists, religious lunatics, presumptuous novelists, animal rights activists, students of politics, and all the other breeds of fundamentalists who profess strange objections to his life's work. In the past few months, since his future mouse had gained some public attention, he had been forced to believe in these people, believe they actually existed en masse, and this was as hard for him as being taken to the bottom of the garden and told that here lived fairies. I mean, they talk about progress, said the girl shrilly, becoming somewhat excited. They talk about leaps and bounds in the field of medicine, yada yada yada, but bottom line, if somebody knows how to eliminate undesirable qualities in people, do you think some government's not going to do it? I mean, what's undesirable? There's just something a little fascist about the whole deal. I guess it's a good book, but at points you do think, where are we going here? Millions of blondes with blue eyes, male older babies. I mean, if you're Indian like me, you've got something to worry about, yeah? And then they're planting cancers in poor creatures. Like, who are you to mess with the makeup of a mouse? Actually, creating an animal just so it can die It's like being God. I mean, personally, I'm a Hindu, yeah? I'm not religious or nothing. But, you know, I believe in the sanctity of life, yeah? And these people, like, program the mouse. Plot its every move, yeah? When it's going to have kids. When it's going to die. It's just unnatural. Marcus nodded and tried to disguise his exhaustion. It was exhausting just to listen to her. Nowhere in the book did Marcus even touch upon human eugenics. It wasn't his field, and he had no particular interest in it. And yet this girl had managed to read a book almost entirely concerned with the more prosaic developments in recombinant DNA, gene therapy, proteins to dissolve blood clots, the cloning of insulin, and emerge from it full of the usual neo-fascist tabloid fantasies. Mindless human clones, genetic policing of sexual and racial characteristics, mutated diseases, etc. Only the chapter on his mouse could have prompted such an hysterical reaction. It was to his mouse that the title of the book referred. Again, the agent's idea. And it was his mouse upon which media attention had landed. Marcus saw clearly now what he had previously only suspected. That if it were not for the mouse, there would have been little interest in the book at all. No other work he had been involved with seemed to catch the public imagination, like his mice. To determine a mouse's future stirred people up, precisely because people saw it that way. It wasn't determining the future of a cancer, or a reproductive cycle, or the capacity to age. It was determining the future of the mouse. People focused on the mouse in a manner that never failed to surprise him. They seemed unable to think of the animal as a sight, a biological site for experimentation into heredity, into disease, into mortality. The mouseness of the mouse seemed inescapable. A picture from Marcus's laboratory of one of his transgenic mice, along with an article about the struggle for a patent, had appeared in the Times. Both he and the paper received a ton of hate mail from factions as disparate as the Conservative Ladies Association, the anti-vivisection lobby, the Nation of Islam, the rector of St. Agnes's Church, Berkshire, and the editorial board of the far-left Schnews. Nina Begum phoned to inform him that he would be reincarnated as a cockroach. Glenard Oak, always acute to a turning media tide, retracted their invitation for Marcus to come to school during National Science Week. His own son, his Joshua, still refused to speak to him. The insanity of all of it genuinely shook him. The fear he had unwittingly provoked. And all because the public were three steps ahead of him like Oscar's robot. They had already played out their end games, already concluded what the result of his research would be, something he did not presume to imagine. Full of their clones, zombies, designer children, gay genes. Of course, he understood the work he did involved some element of moral luck. So it is for all men of science. You work partly in the dark, uncertain of future ramifications, unsure what blackness your name might yet carry, what bodies will be laid at your door. No one working in a new field doing truly visionary work can be certain of getting through his century or the next without blood on his palms. But stop the work, gag Einstein, tie Heisenberg's hands, what can you hope to achieve? But surely, Marcus began, more rattled than he expected himself to be. Surely, that's rather the point. All animals are in a sense programmed to die. It's perfectly natural. If it appears random, that's only because we don't clearly understand it, you see. We don't properly understand why some people seem predisposed to cancer. We don't properly understand why some people die of natural causes at 63 and some at 97. Surely it would be interesting to know a little more about these things. Surely the point of something like an Onca mouse is that we're given the opportunity to see a life and a death stage by stage under the micro... Yeah, well, said the girl, putting the book in her bag. Whatever. I've got to get to Gate 52. It was nice talking to you. But yeah, you should definitely give it a read. I'm a big fan of Surrey T. Banks. He writes some freaky shit. Marcus watched the girl and her bouncing ponytail progress down the wide walkway until she merged with other dark-haired girls and was lost. Instantly, he felt relieved and remembered with pleasure his own appointment with Gate 32 and Majid Iqbal, who was a different kettle of fish, or a blacker kettle, or whatever the phrase was. With 15 minutes to spare, he abandoned his coffee, which had gone rapidly from scalding to lukewarm, and began to walk in the direction of the lower 50s. The phrase, a meeting of minds, was running through his head. He knew this was an absurd thing to think of a 17-year-old boy, but still he thought it, felt it, a certain elation, maybe equal to the feeling his own mentor experienced when the 17-year-old Marcus Chalfen first walked into his pokey college office. A certain satisfaction. Marcus was familiar with the mutually beneficial smugness that runs from mentor to protege, and back again. Ah, but you are brilliant and deign to spend your time with me. Ah, but I am brilliant and catch your attention above all others. Still, he indulged himself, and he was glad to be meeting Majid for the first time, alone, though he hoped he was not guilty of planning it that way. It was more a series of fortunate accidents. The Iqbal's car had broken down, and Marcus's hatchback was not large. He had persuaded Samad and Alsana that there would not be enough room for Majid's luggage if they came with him. Millet was in Chester with Kevin and had been quoted as saying, in language reminiscent of his Mafia video days, "I have no brother." Irie had an exam in the morning. Joshua refused to get in any car if Marcus was in it. In fact, he generally eschewed cars at present, opting for the environmentally ethical option of two wheels. As far as Josh's decision went, Marcus felt as he did about all human decisions of this kind. One could neither agree nor disagree with them as ideas. There was no rhyme nor reason for so much of what people did, and in his present estrangement from Joshua, he felt more powerless than ever. It hurt him that even his own son was not a Chalfenist as he'd hoped. And over the past few months he had built up great expectations of Majid, and this would explain why his pace quickened, gate 28, gate 29, gate 30. Maybe he had begun to hope, begun to believe, that Majid would be a beacon for right-thinking Chalfenism. Even as it died a death here in the wilderness, they would save each other. This couldn't be faith, could it, Marcus? He questioned himself directly on this point as he scurried along. For a gate and a half, the question unnerved him. Then it passed and the answer was reassuring. Not faith, no, Marcus, not the kind with no eyes. Something stronger, something firmer, intellectual faith. So, gate 32. It would be just the two of them, then meeting at last, having conquered the gap between continents, the teacher, the willing pupil, and then that first historic handshake. Marcus did not think for a second it could or would go badly. He was no student of history, and science had taught him that the past was where we did things through a glass, darkly, whereas the future was always brighter, a place where we did things right, or at least righter. He had no stories to scare him concerning a dark man meeting a white man, both with heavy expectations, but only one with the power. He had brought no piece of white cardboard either, some large banner with a name upon it, like the rest of his fellow waiters, and as he looked around gate 32, that concerned him. How would they know each other? Then he remembered he was meeting a twin, and remembering that made him laugh out loud. It was incredible and sublime, even to him, that a boy should walk out of that tunnel with precisely the same genetic code as a boy he already knew, and yet in every conceivable way be different. He would see him and yet not see him. He would recognize him, and yet that recognition would be false. Before he had a chance to think what this meant, whether it meant anything, they were coming towards him, the passengers of BA Flight 261, a talkative but exhausted brown mob who rushed towards him like a river, turning off at the last minute as if he were the edge of a waterfall. "Namaskar, salam alaikum, kamanako." This is what they said to each other and their friends on the other side of the barrier. Some women in full purda, some in saris, men in strange mixtures of fabrics, leather, tweed, wool and nylon, with little boat hats that reminded Marcus of Nehru. Children in jumpers made by the Taiwanese and rucksacks of bright reds and yellows, pushing through the doors to the concourse of gate 32. Meeting aunts, meeting drivers, meeting children, meeting officials, meeting suntanned, white-toothed airline representatives. "You are Mr. Chalfen?" Meeting minds. Marcus lifted his head to look at the tall young man standing in front of him. It was Millet's face. Certainly, but it was cleaner cut, and somewhat younger in appearance. The eyes were not so violet, or at least not so violently violet. The hair was floppy in the English public school style and brushed forward. The form was ever so thickly set and healthy. Marcus was no good on clothes, but he could say at least they were entirely white and that the overall impression was of good materials, well made and soft. And he was handsome. Even Marcus could see that. What he lacked in the Byronic charisma of his brother, he seemed to gain in nobility, with a sturdier chin and a dignified jaw. These were all pins in haystacks, however. These were the differences you notice only because the similarity is so striking. They were twins from their broken noses to their huge, ungainly feet. Marcus was conscious of a very faint feeling of disappointment that this was so. But superficial exteriors aside, there was no doubting, Marcus thought, who this boy Mudgett truly resembled. Hadn't Mudgett spotted Marcus from a crowd of many? Hadn't they recognized each other just now at a far deeper, fundamental level? Not twinned like cities or the two halves of a randomly split ovum, but twinned like each side of an equation, logically, essentially, inevitably. As rationalists are wont, Marcus abandoned rationalism for a moment in the face of the sheer wonder of the thing. This instinctive meeting at gate 32, Mudgett had strode across the floor and walked directly to him, finding each other like this in a great swell of people, 500 at least. What were the chances? It seemed as unlikely as the feet of the sperm who conquer the blind passage towards the egg, as magical as that egg splitting in two. Mudgett and Marcus. Marcus and Mudgett. Yes, Mudgett, we finally meet. I feel as if I know you already. Well, I do, but then again, I don't. But bloody hell, how did you know it was me? Mudgett's face grew radiant and revealed a lopsided smile of much angelic charm. Well, Marcus, my dear man, you are the only white fellow at gate 32. The return of Mudgett Mahfuz Murshid Mubtism shook the houses of Iqbal, Jones and Chalfan considerably. I don't recognize him, said Alsana to Clara in confidence, after he had spent a few days at home. There is something peculiar about him. When I told him Millat was in Chester, he did not say a word, just a stiff upper lip. He hasn't seen his brother in 8 years. But not a little squeak, not a whisperoo. Samad says this is some clone. This is not an Iqbal. One hardly likes to touch him. His teeth, he brushes them 6 times a day. His underwear, he irons them. It is like sitting down to breakfast with David Niven. Joyce and Irie viewed the new arrival with equal suspicion. They had loved the one brother so well and thoroughly for so many years, and now suddenly this new yet familiar face, like switching on your favourite TV soap, only to find a beloved character slyly replaced by another actor with a similar haircut. For the first few weeks, they simply did not know what to make of him. As for Samad, if he had had his way, he would have hidden the boy away forever, locked him under the stairs, or sent him to Greenland. He dreaded the inevitable visits of all his relatives, the ones he had boasted to, all the tribes who had worshipped at the altar of the framed photograph. When they caught an eyeload of this Iqbal the younger, with his bow ties and his Adam Smith and his E.M. Bloody Forster and his atheism. The only upside was the change in Alsana, the A to Z. Yes, Samad Mia. It is in the top right-hand drawer. Yes. That's where it is. Yes. The first time she did it, he almost jumped out of his skin. The curse was lifted. No more maybe, Samad Mia. No more possibly, Samad Mia. Yes, yes, yes. No, no, no. The fundamentals. It was a blessed relief, but it wasn't enough. His sons had failed him. The pain was excruciating. He shuffled through the restaurant with his eyes to the ground. If aunts and uncles phoned, he deflected questions or simply lied. Millat? He's in Birmingham, working in the mosque, yes, renewing his faith. Mudgett? Yes, he is marrying soon, yes, a very good young man, wants a lovely Bengali girl, yes, upholder of traditions, yes. So, first came the musical living arrangements, as everybody shifted one place to the right or left. Milat returned at the beginning of October, thinner, fully bearded, and quietly determined not to see his twin on political, religious, and personal grounds. If Majid stays, said Milat, De Niro this time, I go. And because Milat looked thin and tired and wild-eyed, Samad said Milat could stay, which left no other option but for Majid to stay with the Shalfans, much to Alsana's chagrin, until the situation could be resolved. Joshua, furious at being displaced in his parents' affections by yet another Iqbal, went to the Joneses, while Irie, though ostensibly having returned to her family home on the concession of a year off, spent all her time at the Chalfans, organizing Marcus's affairs so as to earn money for her two bank accounts, Amazon Jungle Summer 93 and Jamaica 2000, often working deep into the night and sleeping on the couch. The children have left us, they are abroad, said Samad over the phone to Archie, in so melancholy a fashion that Archie suspected he was quoting poetry. They are strangers in strange lands. They've run to the bloody hills, more like, replied Archie grimly. I tell you, if I had a penny for every time I've seen Irie in the past few months, he'd have about 10 pence. She was never home. Irie was stuck between a rock and a hard place, like Ireland, like Israel, like India. A no-win situation. If she stayed home, there was Joshua berating her about her involvement with Marcus's mice. Arguments she had no answer for, nor any stomach. Should living organisms be patented? Is it right to plant pathogens in animals? Irie didn't know, and so, with her father's instincts, shut her mouth and kept her distance. But if she was at the Chalfans, working away at what had become a full-time summer job, she had to deal with Majid. Here the situation was impossible. Her work for Marcus, which had begun 9 months earlier as a little light filing, had increased sevenfold. The recent interest in Marcus's work meant she was required to deal with the calls of the media. Sackfuls of post, organize appointments. Her pay had likewise increased to that of a secretary. But that was the problem. She was a secretary, whereas Majid was a confidant, an apprentice and disciple, accompanying Marcus on trips, observing him in the laboratory. The golden child, the chosen one. Not only was he brilliant, but he was charming. Not only was he charming, but he was generous. For Marcus, he was an answer to prayers. Here was a boy who could weave the most beautiful moral defenses with a professionalism that belied his years. Who helped Marcus formulate arguments he would not have had the patience to do alone. It was Majid who encouraged him out of the laboratory, taking him by the hand, squinting into the sunlit world where people were calling for him. People wanted Marcus and his mouse, and Majid knew how to give it to them. If the new statesman needed 2,000 words on the patent debate, Majid would write while Marcus spoke, translating his words into elegant English, turning the bald statements of a scientist disinterested in moral debates into the polished arguments of a philosopher. If Channel 4 News wanted an interview, Majid explained how to sit, how to move one's hands, how to incline one's head. All this from a boy who'd spent the greater proportion of his life in the Chittagong Hills, without television or newspaper. Marcus, even though he had a lifelong hatred of the word, even though he hadn't used it since his own father clipped his ear for it when he was 3, was tempted to call it a miracle, or at the very least, extremely fortuitous. The boy was changing his life, and that was extremely fortuitous. For the first time in his life, Marcus was prepared to concede faults in himself. Small ones, mind, but still, faults. He had been too insular, perhaps. Perhaps. He had been aggressive towards public interest in his work, perhaps. Perhaps. He saw room for change, and the genius of it, the master stroke, was that Majid never for a moment let Marcus feel that Chalfanism was being compromised in any way whatsoever. He expressed his undying affection and admiration for it every day. All Majid wanted to do, he explained to Marcus, was bring Chalfanism to the people, and you had to give the people what they wanted in a form they could understand. There was something so sublime in the way he said it, so soothing, so true, that Marcus, who would have spat on such an argument 6 months before, gave in without protest. "There's room for one more chap this century," Majid told him. This guy was a master in flattery. Freud, Einstein, Crick and Watson. "There is an empty seat, Marcus. The bus is not quite full capacity.